I'm here at Kiln Co-working, wonderful co-working site in downtown Salt Lake City. They have a range of offices across the American West. I've started coming into Kiln more recently now that I have a kid at home. It's been tremendously helpful for me to put these podcasts together because home life has become chaos. I just wrapped up a podcast with David Quammen. He is preeminent science author of our times. He's written about a wide range of scientific subjects, from species extinction and biogeography to spillover of viruses from animals into humans, a book called Spillover, really the most comprehensive book on viruses and zoonotic transmission of viruses. That turned into a book on COVID named Breathless and the race for the mRNA vaccine. He's written for magazines for 50 years. He's the only person to ever be entrusted to write a National Geographic magazine cover to cover. Truly a remarkable amount of trust from that institution in David. He's written about what may be the origins of complex cellular life in a book called The Tangled Tree, a subject called horizontal gene transfer, a really fascinating subject that opened my eyes to a whole different way of viewing the world and the nature of life and the nature of evolution. And now he's working on a book about cancer, contagious cancer, that Tasmanian devils in Tasmania are spreading cancer contagiously. We talk about all of that and so much more on this podcast. If you're curious about biology, synthetic biology, species extinction, engineering viruses, engineering genetics, curing cancer, all of these subjects are within this podcast. I hope you enjoy.
What are we going to talk about? Everything?
Everything. Yeah. No, it's a pretty free-ranging conversation.
All right, great.
You were just with some scientists at the University of Utah, and you're working on a new book.
A new book. A book about cancer as an evolutionary phenomenon, something I've been interested in for 17 years since I did a piece for Harper's Magazine that ran back in 2007 under the title Contagious Cancer, ended up as a cover story for Harper's.
That sounds terrifying.
With a gruesome 19th century painting of sort of a monster and the words contagious cancer splashed across the cover of Harper's.
Should we be worried? This sounds quite serious.
No, contagious cancer is a very small, special subcategory of what cancer can be as an evolutionary phenomenon. And the contagious cancer I was mostly writing about is something that's in the Tasmanian devil, this marsupial carnivore, marsupial omnivore, this little animal the size of a bear cub or a piglet that lives on the island of Tasmania, southernmost island of Australia, and has been burdened for the last 30 years with a genuinely contagious form of cancer, contagious tumor. Not a virus that's contagious that triggers cancer, but a genuinely contagious tumor. Very special case, but it reflects the fact that tumors evolve. And I don't want to say very much more than that about it, but now I'm finally back to the subject for a book project.
You were working on that piece, and then the COVID book,
correct,
Breathless, came up and
that's
sort
right
of interrupted.
That's right, yeah.
The process.
Yeah. I had wanted to get back to this for a book for a long time, since 2007, but I was busy writing other books. And then I finally went back to this subject, and my wonderful publisher, Simon & Schuster, said, yes, we want that book now. And I signed a contract, and I went back to Tasmania, started doing more interviewing, updating my information, talking to other scientists about other aspects of cancer as an evolutionary phenomenon. Cancer in humans, which is generally not contagious, generally. And I was in Tasmania in February of 2020 when COVID, yep, started to explode.
Wow.
Didn't surprise me because the signals were clear in January of 2020. I even wrote an op-ed for the New York Times on this virus coming out of Wuhan. The Times had contacted me and said, hey, Quammen, isn't it time for you to do another op-ed for us about whatever you might have on your mind? Oh, for instance, maybe even this new virus in Wuhan. And I said, you bet I want to write an op-ed about this virus in Wuhan because this could be the next big one.
You wrote Spillover 10 years prior to that.
Correct.
The definitive works on viruses, viral spillover, zoonotic transmission of viruses.
Right.
You tracked viruses. you became a sort of virus hunter,
right.
A disease cowboy.
I became a tracker of trackers of viruses. I became a sidekick of disease cowboys. I became a chronicler of the people who do the work on those things.
I would be so scared to go into a cave knowing what you know and detail in your book about just how many different viruses, coronaviruses, let's say, in a bat cave exist, how many permutations and how much mutation and sort of random innovation is happening at any point in time within that cave. To go in there and grab big bats and bag them and take blood samples and do that kind of work sounds really high risk to me.
These are brave scientists and smart scientists, and they also love life. So they are sensible, careful scientists for the most part. And when I followed them into these places, I always took any precaution that they were taking. Plus, I tried to stand 3 feet away with my hands behind my back and make sure that nobody handed me either a needle or a squirming giant fruit bat. And I was comfortable with that level of precaution.
And they're not always, if I understood from, I forget which book, maybe Spillover, but they're not always wearing full head-to-toe suits with it. It's too restrictive for their range of motion. They're more comfortable. It reminded me, I'm a rock climber. It reminded me a bit of being skilled in an activity where at a certain point, having too much equipment limits your ability to do the job, and having a sort of comfort level with the job allows you to really pare everything back. They generally didn't seem to have so much protective equipment.
Yes. Then I did a lot of the field work for that in 2007, 2008, 2009. And in some cases, the scientists were wearing a lot of PPE, and I wore a lot of PPE, personal protective equipment, you know, coveralls and gloves and 3 layers of gloves and with the duct taped wrists and goggles and masks.
Like you see in the movies.
Yeah. And in some cases, not. But even in the cases where the scientist was not wearing all that, I think the same scientist today would be wearing that because we know much more now. And there is a greater level of caution and greater level of concern. Some of the things that I describe in Spillover wouldn't happen the same way today. I wouldn't do exactly the same things, and the scientists wouldn't either. But you're right that there's a certain balance, there's a certain limit where you say, okay, this much precaution is necessary, and further precaution makes it impossible to do this work. If you really wanted to stretch it, nobody would go into a cave collecting bats to sample for viruses. But science needs to know about those things, and we've learned a lot from that sort of work. It's still controversial to some degree with some people, but it's important science. And
why bats? Bats seem to be culprit to so many scary, gnarly viruses. From your book, you mentioned they're relatively ancient. They live in relatively dense places. Yeah. They travel efficiently so they can bring things to different.
Yeah.
But bats seem to be the source.
The technical term, the term of art is reservoir host. Every virus that appears for the first time in humans as an infection that causes trouble is a virus that has to have some other host, a cellular host. Viruses are not cells. They are genetic parasites that reproduce in cells of living cellular creatures. Cellular creatures are animals, plants, fungi, bacteria, generally. The viruses that are capable of infecting humans, switching hosts and infecting humans, come from animals, because we're animals, almost without exception. And most of those come from mammals or birds. So the animal in which a virus lives inconspicuously without causing much apparent illness in that species of animal, that population of animals, those animals are the reservoir host.
They sort of live symbiotically at peace within those hosts.
Yes, symbiotically might be putting it a little too strongly because that implies benefit for both. Mm. And there's not necessarily benefit, but there's not great harm for the reservoir host. The reservoir continues to function. And then there's some sort of a contact between humans and the reservoir host, and the virus has an opportunity to spill into a new host. And if it turns out that it can thrive in that new host, then it becomes an infection of that new host, for instance, of humans. Back to your question, why bats? Bats are the reservoir hosts for a lot of the viruses that over the last 50 or 60 years have appeared anew as problematic human infections. Marburg virus, which is related to Ebola virus, comes from Egyptian fruit bats. Rabies bats are some of the reservoirs for rabies, not the only reservoirs for rabies. What else? The original SARS virus, 2003 in China, was found to have its reservoir in fruit bats. Hendra virus in Australia, a nasty, dangerous virus that has only infected a small number of humans, but it's killed half of them, comes from fruit bats, Australian fruit bats. Nipah virus in Bangladesh and Malaysia has been traced to fruit bats. And there are a number of others.
And so, suspicion of Ebola.
And the suspicion of Ebola. Correct. Absolutely correct. And thanks for being so clear on that. Yes, some people say, oh, Ebola comes from bats. Well, probably, but we don't have the gold standard of evidence for that yet.
Likewise with COVID.
Yes.
Suspicion, but...
Strong suspicion that it comes from horseshoe bats in central or southern China. We haven't found the exact population of bats from which it came. So that's... There's still a degree of uncertainty there, but it's strong evidence that that's what we should expect to find. But sometimes it takes a long time to identify the reservoirs. With Marburg virus, it took 41 years after the first outbreak in humans for Marburg to be traced to its reservoir host. Some people say, well, with COVID-19, oh, if it came from a bat, we would have found that by now. We would know that by now.
Not necessarily.
To say that, you have to be ignorant of the history of zoonotic diseases. Zoonotic viruses.
Because there's just so many different permutations, mutations, versions of a SARS-like virus within one particular bat cave. So sampling many different bats will yield many different types of mutated virus.
Right.
They won't necessarily be precisely COVID.
And it could be that the prevalence of the virus that you're looking for in the reservoir host population is low, meaning the percentage of the population that carry that virus at all. Bat species X might be the reservoir host for a particular virus, but bat species X, it might be that only 7% of that population carries the virus at all. And maybe it's seasonal. Maybe it shrinks to 3% in the non-breeding season. So you go in and you sample 100 bats, you might not find the virus, even though that is the reservoir host. So it's difficult. There are a lot of challenges.
Do you think we'll one day be able to create some sort of, let's say, virus that ends bat viruses or change the immunology, change the immune system of bats with genetic engineering, some sort of man-synthetic approach to reducing the probability of terrible disease from bats' immune systems?
No, I don't. I don't say it's impossible, but do I think that that's an avenue that's likely to be worth pursuing? No, I don't. There are millions of viruses out there. We live on a planet that's filled with viruses. My friend, the science writer Carl Zimmer, has published a book called Planet of Viruses, I think. And every species of animals on the planet has its own unique viruses. Nobody knows how many, maybe 10 unique viruses. It's just guesswork. So as long as we have biological diversity on this planet, we will have diversity of viruses. And we don't want to get rid of our biological diversity, and therefore we should resign ourselves to the fact that there will be a lot of viruses. The way to deal with that in terms of protecting humans from pandemic disease, viral pandemics, is to reduce the opportunities for those viruses to spill from their natural hosts, their reservoir hosts, into humans. And the way we do that is by reducing the disruptive contact between humans and bats, between humans and wild animals generally. And that involves a number of things that we can talk about. One, the most obvious, is human contact with wild animals, capturing them or killing them for food, capturing them and shipping them to other places, other parts of the world. The international trade in live wild animals for food or for pets or for other purposes.
Surprisingly large. It's like many billions, maybe tens of billions.
Right. It's a huge business. And it's hurting biological diversity. It's hurting animals and it's hurting humans because it offers great opportunity for viruses to go from wild animals into humans and then spread broadly. So that's the way to deal with this. Another element is industrial scale animal husbandry of domestic animals. We have 33 billion chickens on this planet at a given moment.
That's a lot of chickens.
That's a lot of chickens. And in the course of a year, if I remember the numbers correctly, there are about 70 billion chickens alive over the course of a year. It's turnover, you know, slaughter and new hatchings. And most of those are in big operations, big poultry farms. Those poultry farms are like tinder piled around the base of a wooden building. The wooden building being the human population, the tinder being these places where a spark in the form of a new virus can get into the tinder in the form of 33 billion chickens and set fire to the house.
But so if we're genetically modifying chickens for the purposes of sustenance and food, do you think, similar to the back question, we'll ever get to the point where we're genetically modifying their immune system or some sort of vaccine, let's say, that is from the future that's able to sort of react with more agility
yes.
to novel viruses?
On a virus-by-virus case basis, yes. Or even potentially kinds of viruses, families of viruses, like coronaviruses. That's a family of viruses. The influenzas are part of a family of viruses. We can vaccinate chickens against a virus that we know. We can't vaccinate chickens against a virus that we don't know, as things stand so far.
And you don't think that'll change? That's where I'm curious. It just seems like, from my perspective, so much is happening in the worlds of genetic engineering and in the worlds of cancer research. We're in a renaissance, I guess, is mm-hmm. what it feels like mm-hmm. around synthetic biology.
Yeah.
And there's so much complexity and technological advancement in that space. Feels like it's bubbling. The fundamental science even feels like it's bubbling. Our understanding of really fundamental things is changing sometimes. It's all very exciting. And I guess I'm just wondering the degree to which you think that will change the human enterprise's interaction with viruses.
I certainly agree that we are in a period where science-based medical capacities are exploding. So I'm not going to say this is impossible, that's impossible. Practicable, appropriate, those are different questions. And in a general philosophical sense, I don't think we should count on science and medical science to solve all of the problems created by our own cultural practices, our own population size on the planet, our own desires that we think of as needs. We have to take some responsibility for our culture and not expect science to allow us to do any damn thing that we want because we can create a scientific fix for it.
Because some fix will come, some efficiency will make that better.
Yes. And eventually, to do that, we would have to be reducing some of the things that I love most about this funny little planet, third rock from the sun, that we live on in a minor corner of one particular galaxy, and that is biological diversity.
Yeah.
Wildness. Thing that's hard to describe, as I concede in the introduction to my most recent book, The Heartbeat of the Wild. Wildness is something that I value, that I treasure, and a lot of other people do too. It's hard to define, but it involves biological complexity, biological diversity, ecosystems that are intact. There's a certain amount of unpredictability, also a certain amount of stability built into richly diverse ecosystems.
Diversity breeds resilience.
Yeah. And it's important to say that I don't forget that humans are part of these ecosystems, and humans have been part of these ecosystems 200,000 years, 300,000 years, however long you want to consider the lifespan of Homo sapiens as a species. We are part of these ecosystems. I don't say that wildness has to exclude humans. No, wildness has always included humans, but we're getting to the point where humans are excluding wildness because we want everything our way. We want to own everything. We want to consume everything. We want everything to be safe. And that doesn't leave room for wildness.
Mm. On the virus point and the wildness of viruses, and that it's important to have that diversity of viruses. Mm-hmm. You wrote there's more viruses in the ocean than stars in the observable universe. I thought that was beautiful. And I thought, wow, viruses have an evolutionary benefit. They are sort of like tarot cards. And sometimes they bring good mm-hmm. omens and innovations and new biological functions. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they bring death.
Right.
And
yes.
that's important to evolution. That's important to life. the wild tapestry of viruses.
Absolutely. I wrote about that in my book, The Tangled Tree, of 2018. I wrote it about it again at the request of National Geographic for a piece that was my last piece for National Geographic magazine sometime in, I think it came out in 2021. They asked me, write about, this is in the middle of the pandemic, they said, write a piece about the good viruses, the viruses that have contributed something beneficial to human evolution, human life and human evolution. So I did that. And there are a number of interesting...
What are some?
...cases of that. Well, the one that comes most quickly to mind for me is the group of viruses called endogenous retroviruses. Retroviruses are a family of viruses, a particular family. HIV 1 and 2, most famously, are retroviruses. And retro, backwards, they have that name because they convert their RNA, particular kind of genomic molecule, they convert it into DNA and then insert that into the genomes of the cells that they infect.
It's very permanent.
Backwards, because usually RNA is converted into DNA. RNA is a messenger, among other things, a messenger molecule that carries the information that is converted into DNA, and DNA makes protein. So backwards viruses, in the sense that they convert their RNA into DNA and insert it into the genomes of the cells that they infect. Now, if that is immune cells, as with HIV, then that inserted DNA is this little packet of information that can ride for a long time in immune cells as they replicate themselves and not be expressed as viruses that cause trouble. But then something happens, and suddenly, rather than just being copied into genomes, those little patches express themselves as viruses, and suddenly you have an explosion of HIV particles in the blood, and the person starts to show symptoms. They infect more immune cells, they kill those immune cells, et cetera, et cetera. That's all.
It's a pretty vicious biological mechanism.
That's all the story of AIDS, yes. So that's a very harmful form of retroviruses. There are other retroviruses that insert themselves into other kinds of cells. For instance, in humans, some retroviruses insert themselves into germ cells, egg cells, sperm cells, and the stem cells that make egg cells and sperm cells. And when they do that, those patches become heritable. They're passed down from parent to offspring. They become part of
Below the germline. Is that the right way to say that?
I would say in the germline.
In the germline.
Yeah, in the germline. Yeah, so they're passed down. They're inherited. And then in some cases, so they become permanent, a permanent part of the human lineage. And 8% of the human genome consists of retroviral DNA that has been inserted over millions of years into the mammal lineage.
We are 8% endogenous retrovirus.
Correct.
Historical, archaeological invasion events.
Correct.
That happened.
Yes, 8%. And scientists have figured this out by looking at the genomes and matching these stretches of DNA to known viruses or virus lineages.
And some really important functions have come from that.
Yes, and that's what I'm getting to. My favorite is a human gene that has the name syncytin-2. Syncytin-2 is from an endogenous retrovirus that's been inserted into the mammal lineage for millions of years, even before we became humans. And then different versions of it have been inserted, sort of improving, revising on the syncytin-2 that was already there. And now in humans, that syncytin-2 gene from a virus is responsible for creating a membrane between the placenta and the fetus during human pregnancy that makes possible successful human pregnancy. It's a membrane with a fancy long name, syncytiotrophoblast, if I recall correctly, between the fetus and
the placenta.
And it
regulates
it intermediates nutrient between the fetus and the placenta. Yeah, so it carries waste products from the fetus so that the mother can void those waste products, and it carries nutrients in to the fetus.
This is a critical innovation that allowed humans, mammals, to carry offspring within rather than eggshells outside of the body.
Exactly correct. Yes, it's made possible internal pregnancy. It's one of the modifications that contributed to the possibility of internal pregnancy rather than egg laying.
It's a huge innovation.
It's a huge innovation. It's a big improvement. Laying your eggs on the ground or laying your eggs in a nest in a tree works pretty well for birds. But carrying the fetus in the female's body allows the female to run away from a predator and take that fetus with her, rather than leaving her eggs behind on the ground to be eaten. So it has its big advantages.
And something had to solve for the fact that an embryo, genetics of the embryo are half the mother's, and so genetically looks foreign to the mother's immune system.
That gets us into immunology, which is infinitely more complicated, at least to me, than even virology.
Really?
Okay. Yeah.
I might not be prepared for that.
I'm probably not either. The whole question of how the female deals with the fact that her immune system is designed to react against intruders of all sorts, particularly living intruders with DNA expressed in the form of proteins on the external membrane of cells. How does a female deal with the fact that her fetus itself is carrying only 50% of her genome and 50% of some guy's genome, some guy? Why doesn't the female immune system get rid of that fetus the way it would get rid of a virus or a bacterium? That's much more complicated than endogenous retroviruses.
Yeah.
Some people say that the human immune system is one of the most complex systems in the universe. That's a little bit anthropocentric. You could say the animal immune system or the vertebrate animal immune system.
And we're working to reverse engineer it to solve cancer therapies.
Yeah, yeah. That's one of the things that we're doing. The immunology, every time I read a book about immunology, I feel dumber, because it's just so complex. Even if I learn things and absorb things, it's like, wow, okay, all right, that's very complicated. Anyway, we don't need to understand human immunology to understand how important viruses have been and how they have contributed to human evolution, including with the by way of the gene syncytin 2.
Yeah, there are all these new functions, biological functions, even organs and things that have come from invasion events.
Yeah.
And there's also, even in the tangled tree, right, the huge step of life from prokaryotes to eukaryotes, or from simple bacterial life without a nucleus to complex life. That was an invasion event.
Right, but not involving viruses.
Bacteria.
Bacteria within bacteria.
But this is a theme, and this theme has profound, to me, it fills me with a feeling of wonder and mysticism. It changes my perception of certainly viruses and bacteria, but I'm seeing things that seem like threats or are potentially deadly are features, not bugs. They are evolutionary mechanisms. They're catalysts for evolution.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. I mean, creatures living within us, we think of that as infection, and that sounds like a bug, but creatures living within us is really a feature of human existence, of animal existence. The concept of an individual is a concept that can be deconstructed when you start to look at the evolutionary history and the biology. Because, you know, my colleague and friend Ed Yong has published a book about the microbiome under the title I Contain Multitudes. And all those who study the microbiome understand this. And I write about this in The Tangled Tree, too, that we are creatures within creatures. That's our individuality, our unitary individuality. In fact, we contain all kinds of bacteria and other microbes routinely, not just the ones that sometimes make us sick, but the ones that keep us well, the ones that help us digest food.
Alcohol.
Yeah. We contain lots of microbial flora and fauna.
And they affect our immune system. They affect our brain functioning, our mental health, mm-hmm. our physical health. They affect everything.
Yeah. And within our cells themselves, I mean, I'm just talking with the microbiome, you're talking about the cellular creatures that live inside our tummies and inside our pores, in our eyelashes, but not in our cells. But our cells themselves are composites. What's called the eukaryotic cell, the complex cell with a cell membrane and cellular organs, we now understand, and we have understood for decades, is the result of essentially one microbe swallowing another microbe, and then instead of that swallowed microbe being digested, that microbe found a way to be now I'll use the word symbiont, have a symbiotic relationship. And the mitochondria, the little bodies that we have in all of our cells that
they create energy,
that create package energy for us, those are captured bacteria from two billion years ago.
So the genomic sequence, if you looked at the genetics of mitochondria in my cell or your cell, it would be different than the genetics of you, of your body.
Of your nuclear genome, yeah. You know, the nucleus is the sort of the command center inside each cell that contains and protects your primary genome, the genome that you inherit equally from your mother and your father. And then outside of the nucleus, there are these little bodies floating around, these little energy packaging bodies that also contain DNA, also contain smaller genomes. And those genomes are the genome of your mother, because when eggs and sperm cell meet to create the first stage of a human life, one egg cell and one sperm cell meeting, the egg cell is carrying mitochondria and the sperm cell is not carrying mitochondria. So the inheritance, the mitochondrial DNA comes entirely from your mother.
Do you think, now, as we're starting to understand these things, as you detail in your book, science is starting to understand the sort of history of these events. Phylogenetics would be the term for this field, almost like geology is to the earth, the study of what's happened on the earth.
Yeah, phylogenetics, another way of saying that is the study of family trees.
Yeah, we're understanding that various events have happened, symbiont relationships have formed, our genetics are rather complicated within the cell, outside the cell, the microbiome is made up of a bunch of different stuff. Do you think humans will get to the point of experimenting with accelerating what is an evolutionary process? Do you think we will? Maybe not in us, maybe it's in a plant, let's say, but maybe one day it is us. Maybe we are one day experimenting with endogenous retroviruses, which sounds super crazy and futuristic and scary, but we're starting to understand the fundamentals or sometimes whole new categories or functions of the story of life emerge.
It's already happening. In fact, it's been happening for a long time. There are two different forms in which it's been happening. We have been accelerating evolution ever since the first person said, I found these seeds of a plant that will later be known as wild wheat, and I've planted them, and I've noticed that some of them grew fairly high, and they had a lot of more further seed pods, seed, you know, germs, fruit. Wheat is a grass, but it has fruits. Some more than others. I took the ones that grew really well and produced a lot of seed, and I planted those seeds, and I ignored these seeds. You know, artificial selection, human modification, human domestication of animals and plants. We've been speeding evolution ever since then. You know, we managed to domesticate the dog. We were speeding evolution.
The tools seem much higher fidelity now. The genetic tools now.
They're more precise. And they can, and we can do it more quickly. So, for instance, now we have the tool that's known as CRISPR-Cas, CRISPR/Cas9. And it's this amazing tool that allows for very precise gene editing. And everybody said, this is wonderful, but it's also fraught with dangers and moral complexities and things. And before you know it, people are going to be gene editing human embryos for perhaps good or perhaps trivial reasons. And then before you knew it, there was a scientist in China. I forget his name.
He engineered HIV resistance.
So he said, yes, I'm going to do that. I'm going to use CRISPR to engineer some human embryos that contain a gene modification that will make them, I can't remember if it's resistant to HIV or incapable of passing HIV on to their offspring.
This is in the germline.
Yes, in the germline, yeah. And he got in a ton of trouble for doing that. And critics who have written about that pointed out that that modification, I can't remember the details, but that modification is really of no value in protecting people or of marginal value in protecting the unborn, the modified unborn from HIV anyway. Anyway, he has done that, very controversial.
Without
so what's
state
happening?
Support or not a huge amount of resource. It's like a rogue scientist.
Oh, he went to jail. He went to
jail in China.
He's out now, I think. Yeah.
So doesn't that suggest that certainly other people somewhere are using these tools in ways that wouldn't would not be acceptable to the highest standard of ethics.
That's a reasonable supposition. Yeah. I can't say for sure, but yeah, you would think so. You know, I mean, are people trying to make atom bombs in laboratories in chaotic countries? Probably. We've known that to be mm-hmm. a possibility for decades and decades. Making a fission bomb, an atomic bomb, does not require really any scientific secrets. Hasn't for a long time. It requires a certain amount of industrial capacity to get enriched uranium or plutonium, and then you put it together, and it's...
But this seems like it can be done in a lab. The CRISPR, can be done in a relatively simple lab.
This does not require that industrial capacity.
Makes it very hard to track, very hard to track.
You know, a graduate student in a garage could be doing this, yes. They probably are, some of them, somewhere in the world. It probably is being done. The guy in China did this and then broadcast it, bragged about it, and then there was reaction, and then Chinese officialdom cracked down on him, and he went to prison.
Do you think the military would be secretly, my supposition, and maybe this reveals biases on my part, but I would believe that the military is all over this, at least in terms of understanding it and trying to leverage it as a new tool for its own aims.
You mean CRISPR?
CRISPR and genetic modification. It just seems like there's a long history of the military being slightly ahead of the curve or at scale with a capital base and an industrial base to use new tools for its purposes.
I won't disagree with that, but there's also a long history of people imagining that the military is doing things that, you know, that they could be doing this. They could be doing this. They could be creating
viruses. There's a boogeyman in the shadow.
They could be creating killer viruses mm-hmm. to use against our enemies, or they could be creating killer viruses to use against us. Is that possible? Yes. Does it make sense? Not very good sense.
You haven't seen evidence of that. I was actually going to ask you this about COVID and your book Breathless and mm-hmm. you know, the controversy of where the virus came from and all that. And you detail the evidence on both sides, or the conjecture on both sides, artfully and fairly. I thought it revealed a ton to me. But the military story, whatever that is, isn't, I just haven't seen that anywhere, which either means there isn't a military story in terms of militaries involved in virus mm-hmm. level up research mm-hmm. or involved specifically in COVID, whether it's mm-hmm. People's Liberation Army mm-hmm. or the DOD. The military story around all of this stuff seems to just not exist in the public domain, I guess.
Well, there's a long history of effort in what are called in biological warfare, bioweapons. The U.S. was doing some of that research until, as far as we know, until the 1970s, doing research with the idea of active biowarfare weapon research as opposed to defensive biowarfare research. And the Russians, under the Soviet regime, continued doing it long after the U.S. stopped doing it, or at least reportedly stopped doing it. There was a laboratory in, if I recall correctly, Western Siberia called Vector, V-E-K-T-O-R. Sounds like something out of a James Bond.
Yeah, it does.
Movie, but that was real. And it still exists. Is it still doing active, aggressive attack, offensive biowarfare research, or is it only doing defensive? Hard to know. We don't know. So there's plenty of, there are memoirs about that. There are histories about that. I've read some of them. I have a friend who spent time at Vector, and he has written about this.
And he's not James Bond.
And he's not James Bond. I won't even mention his name because I don't want to complicate his life, although he's not secretive about it. He's a very, very smart, cool virologist friend of mine. Speaks a lot of languages. Anyway, so there's no absence of information about that, of concern about that, of some real history of that being done, but there's little or no evidence that it's ever been used or even proven very useful, because the militaries of the various different nations, you know, you have to apply a certain level of common sense as well as a level of suspicion. Military-like weapons, they can aim. Bioagents are very difficult to aim.
That's a really good point. Yeah.
Military, my assumption is that they're not morally above doing that kind of thing, but it's not the best way to go. Maybe they want to investigate it to see if it's possible. Maybe they want to investigate what heinous things could be done in order to have some understanding of what the opposition might be doing. That sort of research has gone on. It probably continues to go on. But do I stay awake at night worried about the fact that the Chinese military or the U.S. military or the Russian military may be working hard to design really terrifying new killer virus? No, I'm more worried about thermonuclear bombs because they're much easier to aim.
It's a good point. Yeah, I think that is one of the clouds over at least the COVID controversy that's sort of unresolvable and therefore fodder for a perpetual conspiracy. How much money from the military went to level up research? And there's so many unanswerable questions.
Yeah.
And so therefore it becomes a big conspiracy.
Yeah. And people love conspiracies. People love the stories of conspiracies. I've written about that. I wrote a long piece for the New York Times Magazine that was published last summer, July of 2023, on the question of the origin of the COVID virus and the question about the question, which is if the evidence that it was most likely a natural spillover of a natural virus from a wild animal, if that body of evidence is much more substantive than any evidence suggesting that it leaked from a laboratory, was engineered or not, if the body of empirical evidence is on the natural origin side of the balance, why is the balance of public opinion on the conspiracy lab leak side of the balance? And it is. And not just in the United States, in a lot of countries around the world. People prefer to believe in a lab leak.
There's a lot of distrust.
A conspiracy, yes. There's a lot of distrust. It's a more dramatic narrative. People have boring lives and they want dramatic stories. So they embrace that.
How you interpret this story, this controversy, it's a Rorschach, sort of. It's a reflection of your own biases, your own... lens through which you see the world.
One scientist said to me, it's default to your priors, your prior beliefs, your prior experiences, your prior convictions. Whatever your priors are, that becomes the lens through which you see all of the evidence, all of the suppositions, all of the accusations, any question, and in this case of this particular question, the origin of the COVID-19 virus, SARS-CoV-2.
Yeah, it becomes controversy in politics then. Puts its sort of tribal affiliation,
yep,
congealing form factor around groupthink.
Yep. It becomes politicized, it becomes polarized, it becomes tribal, it becomes that extreme Republican congressmen make a living, advance their careers by promoting, which is terrible, which is a big problem.
So how to save science? So science, you know, you write science books. You're one of the best science writers of a generation. You love science. It feels to me that what's happening to science, and I think both sides are guilty of this, by the way, that's my own belief, it's being politicized and it's weakening the foundation of science. It's certainly weakening trust.
Yes, it's weakening trust in science and weakening the practice of science. It is impairing science, and that's bad. That's really bad. Those two things go together. The less the public trusts science, the less the public will support science financially and in other ways, culturally, and the more the public will allow politicians, opportunistic politicians, to put all sorts of constraints on science that make the practice of science more difficult. I've been told by scientists who specialize in coronavirus research for decades, long before it was fashionable, long before COVID, long before SARS-1 even, I've been told that some of those coronavirus specialists are throwing out their material that they've worked on for decades and getting out of the coronavirus business because it's now too politically unpopular. And therefore, we're in danger of being blinded about
the next one.
About coronavirus dynamics, yes.
Okay, I'm going to wade into something that is my own opinion, but I think there's also a habit of science being used to implement value system on people by politicians. Mm-hmm. So I think the left does this, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
So, give me an example, Ted.
Yeah.
Just to let me know what you're talking about.
I think a lot of the backlash around the mRNA vaccine, whether people didn't understand it, but there was a value system being imposed on people in the name of science in that example. And I think that's the part people react to. I would argue it does also happen in the climate space. I ardently believe in climate change. Here's a really interesting way to say it. Do you think it's possible to critique things like this that I'm attempting to wade into without being against science? You know, it's a really tricky line to walk.
Yeah, I think it is possible. It's not just possible, it's important. It might be difficult, but not impossible. And it's certainly important. Yeah, we have to be able to critique science. And we have to be able to critique the left as well as the right. You know, those are big abstractions
that
contain a multitude of variations, obviously. But yes, one side of the political divide in this country, just for an example, does not have a monopoly on wisdom about what the societal constraints on science should be, or what is being done, or what might be happening that shouldn't happen. There's no monopoly on who's right about that, who's wise about that. But there are trends. And let's go back to your example of the mRNA vaccines, plural. I tell the story. There are several books that are just about the development of COVID-19 vaccines. So, and I've read them, a couple of them at least, good books, valuable to me when I was writing my book, Breathless. And my book contains one section devoted to the development of one of the mRNA vaccines, the Moderna vaccine. And I talked with Barney Graham at the Vaccine Research Center, who led that effort. And I talked with Tony Fauci about it. And it's an interesting story. And it happened in record time. And I consider it one of the great successes in an otherwise botched response to COVID-19. But I knew from the beginning, and other people knew, that there would be, with this pandemic, a tension, a very basic tension, that would underlie vaccine development, among other things. And that's the tension between individual liberty and public health.
Yeah.
From January of 2020, when I saw and other people saw, okay, this is probably going to be a pandemic, one of the first things I thought was, okay, this is going to be a huge train wreck between individual liberty and public health, especially in the United States, but not only in the United States. Why especially in the United States? Because we care about individual liberty.
It's in our roots.
A huge amount. It's in our roots. And we care about it in good ways, and we also care about it in stupid ways. We've got this, the romance of the cowboy, the lone individual out here in the West with a six-shooter on his hip, making his own law. All that
it's our mythology.
Yes. My wife's most recent book is about the American West as a museum of toxic myths. And that's one of the myths that she writes about, a book called True West. It's sort of an ironic title because most of those myths are not really true. But so it's hugely important to the U.S., to Americans. And so there's a clash between individual liberty and public health.
And at the center of the vaccine math, you need a certain amount of the population to receive a vaccine for it to be effective or minimize bad outcomes. So that's therein lies the rub.
That's right. If you're going to get a vaccine, you're not just getting the vaccine for yourself. You're getting it because you being vaccinated makes your family safer, and you and your family being vaccinated makes all the kids at school safer, makes the whole community safer. So there's two dimensions of that. And the extreme viewpoint on individual liberty is the hell with that. I don't care about that. I only care about me and my family. And I don't have a family. Maybe I'm just a lone guy or a lone woman. Because I live in the West, my attitude is I can do any damn thing that I want because it's me.
There's a lack of a sort of social value cohesion that very different in China.
Yeah, and different in
and India.
A lot of countries, right. That tension is not...
Well, and body autonomy, I think, is, at least historically, has been an important part of our legal system.
Yes, that's where it begins. That's the nucleus of this particular cell that we're talking about.
Yeah.
Body autonomy. And then family. And then property. You know, you hear this in the West. Here we are in the West. It's my property. I can do any damn thing on it and with it that I want. No, there are some constraints on that because you live in a community. You live in a state. You live in a country. And there are rules. And those rules may constrain what you can do on your own property, even. Get over it. Some people don't want to get over it.
Yeah. Okay, well...
So the controversy over the development of the mRNA vaccines, the question of vaccine mandates, classic instance of individual liberties versus public health. It's not surprising that it's controversial. Can you solve that with an equation? Do the equation and figure out, okay, she's right and he's wrong. No, it's not that simple.
It's tricky.
It takes the civil discourse of democracy and functional communities and people continuing to talk to one another and listen to one another. Realize that if you live in a community, which everybody does, that implies a certain willingness to compromise.
Yeah, I found it troubling, the entire thing as it unfolded. I mean, I guess it was years ago now, but the controversy around where it came from captured my attention. I'm just a curious person. So it's catnip for a curious person. What happened?
Captured my attention too.
Yeah. And then, you know, the vaccine stuff. This is personal, but we were supposed to do this a month ago. I got shingles, which as a 38-year-old man is pretty unusual. Mm-hmm. Typically much older people get shingles. I have great immune system, good health, did tests, everything great.
Very painful.
Very awful. Yeah, I wouldn't recommend it. It was really hard.
I've been vaccinated against shingles. I'm an old guy. I'm 76. And I got shingles vaccine probably 10 years ago.
Yeah. So I started, because I had it, it started coming up, bubbling up, you know, oh, this person had it, that person had it. There was a lot of sort of anecdotal. I realized that a lot of younger people are getting shingles, or at least anecdotally. So then I looked it up. There is a National Institute of Health study, recent, 2023, it was published, that looked at 1 million patients, unvaccinated and vaccinated. And the incidence of shingles was roughly 2x those who had received the vaccine. I was like, whoa, I mean, that's new information. At least for me, I certainly never was aware that by getting the COVID vaccine, there was an increased risk of shingles.
Oh, okay. So people who've been vaccinated against COVID have had more. I thought for a second you were talking about the shingles vaccine.
No, sorry, the COVID vaccine. That's what this study said. It's still a very low percentage, but it was twice the rate. To me, that's an example of where there's a wrinkle in all of this. It's like maybe public health officials weren't aware of that at the time, and maybe that's why it wasn't presented information. But things like that can generate distrust in the enterprise at play.
Yeah. Yes. That's interesting. And my first reaction to that is I absorb that, and I'm glad to hear that. If I were going to spend more time about it or looking into it, one of the things I would ask was, okay, there is an NIH study, meaning, you know, the NIH funds a lot of studies, and there may be a lot of studies, different studies on the incidence of shingles in people vaccinated against COVID, and that's one study. What do the other studies say? Maybe that's the only study, or maybe there's a consensus of NIH-funded studies that show that same result.
Yeah.
If I were digging deeper, that's one of the ways I would dig. The other thought about it is that scientists and medical people have known for as long as vaccination has been practiced that there are some costs. There are some people who get vaccinated who have negative experiences, who get the disease that they're being vaccinated because there's something wrong with the vaccine, the virus or whatever hasn't been adequately killed or denatured adequately, or some other health side effect. Because when you get vaccinated, it's a challenge to your immune system, and the idea is that your immune system will react to it and create very specific defenses against any further exposure to that particular set of protein signals that virus or bacterium or whatever carries. But the fact that your vaccine, or that your immune system is being challenged, means that perhaps in some people, some minority of people, one aspect of your immune system being challenged by the SARS-CoV-2 vaccine is that they let the shingles virus
Because it's dormant within a body.
Because it's dormant within most of us. Yeah. Most of us, you know, it's chicken pox for grown-ups.
Yeah.
And most of us carry that dormant virus. So a challenge to the immune system could release that, which is unfortunate. And then the question becomes, what's the arithmetic at the population level?
For a public policy decision.
Are more people protected from more harm by administering the vaccine or by refraining from administering the vaccine? And that's the calculus of vaccination.
I'm more familiar with that kind of public policy choice in a clean energy context. I used to work in clean energy, mm-hmm. and You know, our energy system is going to have consequences no matter what it is. Mm-hmm. It's a minimizing of consequence or a balancing of a lot of different factors to sort of aim a complex system over 100 plus years.
What happens to all those discarded batteries from electric cars?
Yeah, and they're right. We don't exactly have an answer to that yet. There are companies like Redwood Systems working to recycle them, but we'll see.
But that's the kind of thing you're talking about, right?
Yeah, exactly. There is a pushback against EVs for that reason. Also, electric vehicles, they use dramatically less energy than a petrol-based car because the amount of energy to move the car forward is through the battery. It's like an 80% efficiency versus it's like a 22% efficiency. Mm-hmm. So there's a factor multiple of less energy use.
Basically. But they use more copper and more cobalt.
Do.
And more coltan. I don't know if there's coltan in electric cars.
I'm not sure.
I know it's in computers and phones. And what are the costs? The human costs and the
you've spent time in the Congo.
Yeah.
I mean, you've seen maybe some of that.
I have seen artisanal mining at a massive scale in the Congo and other parts. I haven't been to the areas of eastern Congo where cobalt and coltan being mined, although I've read a lot about it and I've kind of wanted to go there, but that's a tough reporting assignment. I read a wonderful book by a fellow whose name I can't remember right now called Cobalt Red, I think. About that. He did some heroic reporting about the human and environmental costs of cobalt and coltan mining. So that's the other side of the coin in terms of electrification of our lives.
You know, the attempt in energy is to green our electricity system and make our transport system electric. And there's a public policy rubric. To me, it feels like scientific consensus, to use an analogy. It feels like there's a sort of public policy consensus for that outcome. But then there are unintended consequences or there are not yet resolved questions. Mm-hmm. And those at scale are problematic. Mm-hmm. Just like in metaphor, we're talking about the COVID vaccine and the public policy rubric around to vaccinate everybody or to mandate vaccinations in certain contexts. And it's tough.
It is tough. It is tough, which is why we need good science communication. We need dialogue. We need people to believe in this process of science and to understand what it is. Understand that science is not a body of final truths. Science is a process, a human process of incremental movement toward more and more accurate understanding of the material universe through the epistemological methods that we call science, which includes correcting of mistakes.
What excites you the most right now in, you know, from your seat in scientific discoveries? And are there areas that really light you up right now that you're just very excited about? Maybe it's what you're researching for your book.
It is. That's the first thing that comes to mind.
Yeah.
Scientists that I've been talking with here in Salt Lake yesterday and today about cancer as an evolutionary phenomenon, the Darwinian understanding of cancer, both of how animals over millions of years have evolved ways to suppress cancer.
Like elephants.
Forms of resistance to cancer. Elephants, you've heard that elephants rarely get cancer. Yeah. They should get a lot of cancer. The people I'm talking to here are right on top of that. That's their research work.
They have 40 times the P53 protein, if I'm not two alleles, but yeah, they have many more proteins that are involved in the immune system.
The African elephant has 20 diploid copies of the TP53 gene that creates the protein P53 that helps to suppress cancer, 20 times the number that humans do. I just had coffee with Josh Schiffman, whose laboratory here at the Huntsman Cancer Institute in Salt Lake works on that.
Cool.
He and his colleagues, people in his lab and his scientific colleagues, and another scientist named Christopher Gregg, that I skied with yesterday and talked to for 8 hours, they are in the middle of exploring that.
Because in understanding that, we pathways to curing cancer, preventing cancer, if we can control the P53 protein, we can better address cancer.
Possibly, yeah. That's what they're exploring. And I don't want to say too much about that because they're still doing the research and they're publishing the papers. And they should be the ones to talk about it first. And I'm going to talk about it certainly in my book. But yes, that lights me up. There are things going on there that are very important and exciting.
I've been following Colossal the de-extinction company.
George Church's.
Yeah, he's involved in quite a provocative goal, you know, bring back the woolly mammoth. But mm-hmm. they're also, I believe, archiving the genetic material of highly endangered species, of species that maybe don't even exist in the wild anymore, trying to preserve to potentially bring back to life at a future date. But there's a study that they did. They, in the woolly mammoth research, are attempting to control the P53 protein as well, because it's complicated for them, because they're trying to modify Asian elephants to be like woolly mammoths. It's not really that they're bringing the woolly mammoth mm-hmm. back. They're trying to genetically modify an Asian elephant. And the elephant's P53 proteins are really at the crux, it sounds mm-hmm. like. And so they successfully turned them off, which I'm not sure what the implications of that are, but it sounds like they have a mechanism of controlling the P53 protein in the Asian elephant. And perhaps that allows them to introduce new genetic modifications.
Where did you hear about this or read about this?
I'll send you an article. I'm forgetting the name of the publication. It wasn't a peer-reviewed publication. It was a interview with the CEO.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to say anything about that because I've just been talking with Josh Schiffman about that. So I don't want to say anything because I don't remember what I know from general ambient information and what I know from him. And I don't want to spill any beans that I shouldn't be.
I don't mean to tread so close to the subject that you're writing your book around too.
I've been thinking about that all morning. So you're up to the minute current with the things that I care a lot about. But I'm not ready to talk publicly about those things yet, because I want to be very careful that I get it right and that I don't talk about anything that I happen to know about before it should be public.
Totally fair. Yeah. I'm very excited about all that as well, as you can tell. It seems both from a cancer perspective, but then, and we can segue a little bit into the endangered species side here with conservation through, I mean, this is a radically different approach to conservation. Mm-hmm. And it's from the future. It's species conservation from the future. An example that I'm curious about, maybe circling a little bit back to the idea of engineering viruses for the sake of improving the immune system of bats or something, but goldfinches in Hawaii that are dying from malaria from mosquitoes. Mm-hmm. At what point does it, with such a limited population of remaining finches, at what point does it make sense to, via CRISPR or some sort of synthetic approach, introduce to that population of birds something that fights off malaria, some sort of genetic modification?
Well, I'm all in favor of taking a high-tech approach to saving endangered species. But we have to think about what we're saving and at what cost, whether we're changing something in order to keep something the same and therefore engaged in sort of a futile exercise. That goes back before CRISPR, of course, when there was concern about the survival of the Florida panther, the Florida subspecies, as it was thought, of what we out here in the West call the mountain lion or the cougar. The Florida panther was, the population was numbered in the dozens, in the low dozens, and there was therefore a concern with a small gene pool and possibly inbreeding depression if females only had a few choices for males to breed with, and some of those choices were their sons. People were saying, well, what about getting some mountain lions from Texas and introducing them to Florida to freshen the gene pool? So there was this both a philosophical and a tactical discussion about whether to do that. And the California condor, when the California condor was down to about a dozen individuals in the wild back in the late 70s maybe, there was a discussion about what do we do to save the California condor? Or should we just let it go extinct? Give it the respect and the dignity of just going extinct rather than bringing it into captivity and breeding it, bringing the whole population into captivity and protecting them from the dangers in the wild and breeding them in captivity for some generations and then re-releasing them to the wild. Have then we created a domesticated condor? We don't have the wild California condor anymore. So this has been a philosophical and tactical discussion long before CRISPR. And it remains complicated. The complications are deserving of respect. Philosophical differences of opinion are deserving of respect. And how you apply those to a given case, a particular endemic species of bird in Hawaii or on the island of Guam, where there were also endemic species of bird that went extinct due to the introduction of an invasive tree snake. I wrote about that in my book, The Song of the Dodo, 25 years ago.
Yeah.
the case in Hawaii that you asked about specifically, should we CRISPR engineer those birds to be resistant to malaria? Well, it's worth discussing, but it goes back into that whole philosophical discussion of how much we want to change things in order to keep them the same. There's a little bit of a philosophical paradox there, which needs to be addressed. I would also think that if my recollection is correct, the mosquitoes on Hawaii that carry bird malaria, probably Anopheles mosquitoes, I think it's not just human malaria, but also other forms of animal malaria that's carried by the Anopheles mosquitoes. I'm pretty sure that those are introduced. Those are not native mosquitoes, that this was not an age-old problem. It's a human-caused problem that those mosquitoes are now there. They're carrying the parasite for bird malaria. There are scientists that I know and respect very much who would say, well, we can design a gene drive that will make those mosquitoes incapable of carrying the malarial parasite. So why don't we engineer the mosquitoes rather than engineering the birds? High tech. Yeah, you bet. CRISPR, maybe. Engineer a mosquito that's capable of outcompeting all of the other males or all the other female Anopheles mosquitoes on Hawaii. And that has been engineered to be incapable of supporting the malarial parasite. That would be cool. I'd be in favor of that.
So are you in favor gene drive for mosquitoes versus CRISPR anti-malarial solution for birds? Gene drive for mosquitoes is a better choice in your mind in that instance?
I'm suggesting that maybe it is.
What is it about option A versus option B that makes option A better than option B?
Well, option A, the gene drive in mosquitoes, involves undoing something that humans have done in recent historical time.
I see. That makes sense. Okay, so that's an ethical standard.
I wouldn't even claim the word ethical. I would say I have a philosophical disposition toward that tactic.
Yeah.
But some people would say this whole distinction between an introduced species and an indigenous species, an endemic species, is arbitrary. Mm-hmm. And to some degree, it is arbitrary. But there, at a certain level, all qualitative distinctions are quantitative, if you look at it carefully, because phenomenon and history are continua. And you can, if you look closely enough, you can see that things are calibrated incrementally from one seemingly qualitative distinction to another. I don't want to get too windy about this, but you understand what I'm trying to say.
I'm not sure I do, actually.
So what is a native species versus
an invasive species?
Yeah.
At what point does an invasive species become a new native species?
Right.
Is it 500 years? Is it 10 years? What's the...
Then that's what I'm saying, that it's a quantitative judgment. But quantitative judgments, some of them have real value. And I think it is fair to say that you can talk meaningfully about a native species versus an invasive species if you say, did this creature arrive here as a new species on its own power without human transport, or is it here because of human transport? And if it's here because of human transport, it has happened in something faster and shorter than evolutionary time. And if these original finches in the Galapagos flew in here on a storm 1.5 million years ago and colonized the Galapagos and then gradually moved from island to island and speciated, so there are a number of different species. But they were originally colonized by, you know, maybe 6 finches, 3 males and 3 females that were blown to the Galapagos in a storm 1.5 million years ago. I would call those native species. If then you bring in a blackbird to the Galapagos 50 years ago, or you bring in a brown tree snake from the Solomon Islands to Guam 50 years ago, I would say those are exotic species. Those are invasive species.
Right.
That's just where I would draw the lines of qualitative distinction around what can be seen as just sort of a continuum.
There's a metaphor from Chris, I forget his last name's book. It's called The Inheritors of the Earth, and it's about speciation. It's a look at what's happening with respect to mass species extinction from the speciation lens.
Yeah. Extinction happens quickly and speciation happens slowly.
Very slowly. Yeah. And invasive species are very relevant for speciation because they change. You know, the trees from Spanish conquistadors in California are no longer the same as the same tree in Spain. They've genetically modified over 500 years or whatever.
Trees that were brought in by the conquistadors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's speciation happening to some degree.
But usually it doesn't happen within 500 years.
Right. When plants are probably a lot easier than birds or mammals. but even plants would take much longer than that usually.
Yeah, but plants have a different reproductive system. They can have diploid, polyploid reproduction. Suddenly you get twice the number of chromosomes in one generation, and a plant becomes very different. It doesn't happen with animals.
Yeah, animals are the apex of this speciation game. But the continents converging, when they converged a long time ago.
Pangaea, Wanaland and Pangaea. And
speciation sped up when the continents all combined, my understanding. Maybe you have, I don't know if...
I find that counterintuitive.
You do? Okay.
Yeah. Speciation occurs generally with ecological isolation rather than connection. That's why speciation occurs relatively quickly and dramatically on islands. And that's what I wrote about in the Song of the Dodo. Giant flightless birds. If you got a giant flightless bird, take a guess whether it's likely to be on a mainland or an island.
It'd be on an island. It devolved the ability to fly.
And it evolved the ability to be really big. And
the energy went to that versus the flight.
Yeah. For instance, the iconic case, the dodo on the island of Mauritius. Original lineage was a pigeon lineage. Got to the island of Mauritius because pigeons are good flyers. Pigeons colonize a lot of islands. They're good enough to get to islands on rare occasions, better than some kinds of birds. But once they get to islands, that doesn't mean that they can just continue to colonize that island with more pigeons. They tend to get stuck there. You get isolated enough that they evolve into endemic species of pigeon. The pink pigeon on Mauritius and a number of other endemic species of pigeons across islands of the Pacific. The dodo is a descendant of a pigeon ancestor that got to the island of Mauritius and then got stuck and isolated there. There was a small population. They evolved in the absence of ground-dwelling predatory mammals. There were none on the island of Mauritius. And in the presence of cycles of fruit production by the trees, so that sometimes there was an abundance of fruit, sometimes there was a shortage of fruit. The pigeons that remained really good flyers probably got blown back out to sea. The pigeons that were not such good flyers because they were getting fat, their wings were getting shorter or whatever, those are the ones that stayed. So this trend continued, and the dodo became a big, burly, 40-pound flightless pigeon.
They're 40 pounds? I didn't realize they were that big.
I think they were.
That's huge.
Maybe not quite that big.
Yeah.
But, you know, they became more like a turkey.
And a lot of species in that category, flightless, big birds during the age of exploration, 1500s, 1600s, with the introduction of rats, cats, goats, humans seeking food,
monkeys,
disease, mongooses. All of these things went extinct.
Yeah.
For those reasons.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of the extinctions of the last 500-600 years or 1,000 years is from that age of exploration.
Right. And have we had as many new species evolving on those islands as we have lost in that 500 years?
Yeah. What are your thoughts on that?
No.
There was in this book, and I haven't done the study, but in the Chris Jones, I'm sorry that I'm forgetting his last name, but the book's called Inheritors of the Earth. Mm-hmm. He has a study where he, and I don't know how he's recreating the species diversity from, 700 years ago, but he has a sort of chart with an XY axis of different scatterplot islands and essentially saying there's more diversity of species is what he says in this book. And it's unfair to, you haven't read this book or...
No, but not. I think I...
But it might just be wrong. So I'd love to hear your...
Let me guess what he's talking about.
Please. Yeah.
There are certain species that are more capable of being invaders. I call them weedy species in the sense that animals as well as plants can be weedy. They travel well. They do well on disturbed landscapes. They colonize new environments well. They're broadly adapted. They're highly competitive. And those are the species that get around.
There's more in the sense that there's more of these survivor weedy type species.
Yes. The island of Guam, for instance, might contain, it certainly contains more species of mammals than it did 500 years ago. And those mammals are found everywhere else in the world. Cats, rats, humans. Yeah. What you have is maybe localized increases in biological diversity, but global decreases in biological diversity.
If I understood his argument in this book, that is his argument.
Yeah. Well, that's cold comfort, in my view. To say that now the black rat and the brown rat are distributed on islands across the Pacific where they didn't used to live, and so what that there are some endemic bird species that have disappeared. We've got more mammal species on the island of, on Easter Island and on Guam and in the Marianas Islands. So what?
Yeah, we've lost.
Yeah.
A lot.
I mean, a technical way
of
talking about this is alpha diversity versus beta diversity. And alpha diversity, if I recall correctly, is a measure of how many different species exist in this one place. Beta diversity is a measure of how much does your measure of diversity increase as you move geographically. And if you have alpha diversity on this island, you know, now you've got eight species of mammal on an island that had zero species of mammal. But those eight species are also the same species you find on this island and this island and on that mainland, then it's a net loss in biological diversity for planet Earth.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes sense. And speciation could happen, but it'll take longer.
Usually it takes millions of years.
Yeah.
If it's a very small population, a founder population that becomes isolated suddenly, then that speciation can happen more quickly.
Yeah.
And some people credit this idea to Stephen Jay Gould, but in fact, Ernst Mayr was writing about it in the 1950s, the great German-American naturalist and evolutionary biologist and historian of science, Ernst Mayr, 1954, wrote a paper entitled, or at least about, what he called genetic revolutions, later called punctuated equilibria, evolution making leaps and then pausing and then making leaps. Ernst Mayr's version of it was what he called genetic revolutions, which is that if you get a small founder population of one particular kind of animal that becomes isolated, typically on an island, then because that it's a fairly small population, chance as well as ecological pressures will be able to cause that population to differ, to diverge from the mainland population more quickly than a large population could diverge from the mainland population. Because a large population has more, call it, genetic inertia. Changes in a few individuals because of adaptive reactions to changed ecological circumstances will be less important in a large population than in a small population.
Yeah.
So that's Mayr's theory of genetic revolutions, and that's why adaptations can happen relatively more quickly on islands because of small population. But
right.
Still, I'm saying relatively more quickly. Still, it's not as fast as human-caused change.
In a different podcast, you mentioned a moth during the Industrial Revolution in the UK, I want to say, that changed from a white moth to...
The English, what do they call it? The pepper moth, I think?
Yeah, and it became a black moth with more melanin in its cells, or I don't know exactly how melanin expresses itself, because the trees became sooty. So they were a more visible target for prey as a white moth.
The white moths were more visible.
So that happened really quick.
That happened quickly, yeah. And that's a textbook case that has also been revisited and challenged by more recent scholarship. And I don't know where that stands exactly right now.
Challenged that it didn't happen that quickly, or challenged maybe it's...
I don't remember the detail. I read up on it once, but that was, last time I read up on it was probably 8 years ago. I know which part of my office those books are in, but I haven't touched them recently.
Yeah. What I heard from a different podcast you gave a while ago, maybe many years ago, was that it wasn't a sort of incremental Darwinian natural selection-based evolution path for the moth to go from being a white moth to being a black moth. There was a jump of genetic material. But I forget, there's a word for this, a science word that I'm blanking on.
Transposon?
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah.
That there was a transposon jump of genetic material to this moth. And so it wasn't that the moth, through natural selection, changed over 20, 30 years from white to black via sexual reproduction. It was instead that there was a sort of jump or some jump.
A horizontal gene transfer.
A horizontal gene transfer.
A section of genome carried in perhaps by a viral infection, which is one of the ways horizontal gene transfers happen. Yeah, this is what my book, 2018 book, The Tangled Tree.
Yeah, I mean, that's fascinating in the context of evolution and species, exigent threat to species. That there is a sort of mechanism. It might be slow, it might be ineffective, species are going to go extinct, but sometimes there is this sort of innovation that can happen.
Right. That's one of the things that made me so interested in horizontal gene transfer as to write a book about it. That said, you've brushed up on that more recently than I have.
Yeah. Well, I did a lot of prep for this podcast.
See that? I appreciate that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a lot of subjects that you've covered in all your books.
It's been, yeah. I have had a crazily sinuous career over the last 54 years since I published my first book.
That's incredible. And having that longevity of intention and desire for the same path is rare, in my opinion, in today's world. A lot of people, myself included, jump around.
As I said, it's a sinuous path. The continuity is that I've been a writer, but
right.
My first books were not about molecular evolution.
And did you study this stuff in school? Like, at what point did you, I'm a science writer, and...
Well, that happened somewhat gradually. I was always interested in two things as a kid, writing and nature. And if I'd had mentors on the nature side, I probably would have become a biologist. Instead, I had some very good English teachers who encouraged the writing side beginning in high school, but I was writing in grade school, in high school and then in university. And then I got obsessed with William Faulkner, the novels of Faulkner, did a lot of my undergraduate and all of my graduate work on that. And I emerged from undergraduate with a novel that was fit to be published. So that's when September of 1970, I published my first book, which was a novel. And so for a few years, I thought, okay, do I get to be a novelist now? And then I realized that it wasn't that easy, that yes, I had broken the ice early because I was a combination of lucky and capable, but 13 years passed between my first book and my second book, and I was a bartender, and I was a waiter, and I was a fishing guide. Yeah, it was a long time. So I paid my dues. I just paid them after the first book and before the second book rather than before the first book.
And you were attempting to be a writer in those years. You were trying to hustle opportunities.
The whole time.
The entire
time.
It's hard to be an artist or a freelancer or a creative or a creator of content, whatever you want to call it. It's really hard in the modern world.
It is. And it always has been. In some ways, it's harder now. In some ways, it's easier now.
Yeah.
But I knew by that time that I wanted to be a writer, and I was still discovering which kind of writer. And then I moved to Montana in 73. Now I was in a place with big wildlife and mountains and forests, and I turned back toward my interest in nature and developed that into an interest in biological sciences. I started reading Darwin, I started reading evolutionary biology generally, started reading a lot of things that I'd never read as an undergraduate English major and as a graduate student working on Faulkner. A lot of history of science, a lot of science generally. And then I started writing about that stuff and figuring out by trial and error how to be a magazine writer specializing in natural science.
Would you like just send emails? Or would you go to places and try to...
Ted, this is long before emails existed.
Yeah. Right.
I would send letters.
You'd send letters.
I would send letters.
With writing samples?
Yeah.
And you would...
Yeah. That's how it was done. This was... when was I starting that? Got to Montana in 73, worked on another novel for about 3 years. Most of that novel was never published. Some of it was published. And then in the late 70s, started writing book reviews about scientific books, freelancing, calling up magazines or writing to them and saying, hey, do you want me to review the next Stephen Jay Gould book for you or the next Barry Lopez book for you or this or... At one point, I reviewed the letters of Robert Oppenheimer were published, and I reviewed that for the Christian Science Monitor. Did a lot of science book reviewing for the Christian Science Monitor. Started to develop my chops writing about science, learning about science and writing reviews. And then started pitching, you know, some science stories to magazines. And then Outside Magazine came along. I met the editor-in-chief, and he offered me a column based on some of my work that he had read. So I wrote a column for Outside Magazine for 15 years about natural science. It was called Natural Acts.
That's a long tenor for a magazine.
Yeah.
That's a it's a serious accomplishment to write continuously.
Yeah, I wrote about 156 of those essays over the course of 15 years. Not nearly as long a tenure a record as my friend E. Jean Carroll, who wrote her column for Elle magazine for, I think, 25 years. Mm-hmm. Don't get me started on E. Jean, one of my dearest friends, but that would get us into politics even more than we've already been.
How important is that daily practice? So in writing a column for a magazine, like your productivity, your ability to produce comprehensive books, there's a work ethic there. There's an industriousness, a productivity. And how important is that daily intentional, I'm going to create something?
Very important. The discipline to do it, to sit down and turn out the pages, very important. And I stumbled across that discipline in the autumn of 1968, when I came back to Yale. I was an undergraduate at Yale, came back to Yale after having spent a summer as a community organizer in Chicago in a somewhat dramatic, tense situation. And I had a really good friend who was a black guy.
Named Barack Obama. Yeah.
Before Barack made it.
Because he was a community organizer.
Before, even in Chicago, yeah.
In Chicago.
This is before Barack made it fashionable. It wasn't fashionable in 68. Where was he in 68? He was probably a toddler in Hawaii. But it was a different friend, a friend named Eddie Smith. Mm-hmm. And we had some adventures and misadventures together on the west side of Chicago in a tough neighborhood. And I went back to Yale and I said, I have a story to tell about a friendship in a racially divided time and a racially divided city. And so I based it on autobiographical experience, but I changed it, I developed it, I made it into a shapely story. He became a character, I became a character, but I wasn't just writing about us, I was writing about these characters. And it turned out to be a good enough novel for Alfred Knopf to publish it. But how did I write it? I decided, okay, now I have a story. I have a real story. I have characters. I have a plot. How do I write a novel? And I had tried before that to write novels with inspiration late at night, whatever, but I had nothing to say. I was just a middle-class kid from a happy childhood in Ohio. But now I had a story. So I sat down every morning. I had no classes that year, that term, autumn of my junior year. I had a roommate. We slept in bunk beds. My roommate Skip, still a dear friend, and I would get up early in the morning and come back from breakfast, and I'd sit down at the desk with a yellow legal pad and a number two pencil, and Skip would be snoring in the lower bunk, and I would have 2 hours before my first class, and I would write 3 pages, and I'd make myself write 3 pages with a pencil before it was time to go to class. And I said to myself, if I write 3 pages for 100 days, that's 300 pages, right? That sounds like a book of 300 pages, at least of rough draft. So that's what I did.
And I love that.
And at the end of, you know, sometime in, I don't know, early February, I had a finished draft. And some of it sucked. It needed to be thrown away. And all of it needed to be revised. But there it was. You know, I had this packet of 5-6 yellow legal pads with this novel written in pencil.
Yeah.
And ever since then, the discipline part has been easy for me.
Do you still write every day? Do you try to keep that kind of cadence?
No, because I spend years researching things now
before
I write. But when it's time, I write every day and I sit down. And I've learned with 54 years of experience how to write more slowly than I did then.
What do you mean by that?
I don't write. It's a very rare day that I write 3 pages. I start in the morning with revising whatever pages I wrote the previous day. So I usually print them out on paper. I write now on a computer, but I print them out on paper and I take a pencil and I mark up those pages. Or maybe sometimes I do it on the computer. But anyway, I take yesterday's 2 pages or maybe 3 pages or maybe 1 page of first draft. And first thing in the morning, I turn that into second draft. And then I take a breath, and have breakfast, walk the dogs, whatever. And then I launch with the second half of the writing effort into creating another stretch of first draft.
Yeah. And the research stage, I mean, you spend years researching the latest, the most salient parts of whole new scientific fields and speaking with experts. I mean, it's so content rich. How do you organize and maintain access in your brain to all of the information? I mean,
I read a lot of journal papers and I record what I've read, you know, just a citation. And then I take some notes. I type some notes that'll be searchable notes. And I read books. And I schedule interviews with scientists. And either I go to see them or I do Zoom interviews with them. I get them transcribed, the interviews transcribed, by my wonderful, faithful transcriber, Gloria Thede, who's been doing this for me for 30 years or so. And I go into the field, I have notebooks, and I also have a journal, a little hardback sort of ledger journal that I use as a diary. So I keep both moment-to-moment notes and day-to-day diary of what I'm doing in the field. And then after a few years, I pile all that up on my desk. And I do not make an outline. I don't like outlines. Outlines are fine for some people, but they're not for me. I accumulate potential chapter titles, and the chapter titles tell me essentially what the theme and the range of a given chapter is going to be. And then I start to write. As I say sometimes, I pile all this up on my desk, and then I drink coffee until I go into a trance, and I start to write.
Do you find flow state sometimes in this endeavor?
Flow state?
Flow state, like it all just starts feeling easy and smooth and your brain is connecting to memories and notes that
Sometimes it sails along and it's like it's being given to you, but it's not being given to you. And sometimes it's a grind. And when it's a grind, the trick is to grind it out and then go back and make sure that it doesn't feel like a grind, it doesn't taste like a grind, it doesn't sound like a grind to the reader, because you want every page to feel like a guilty pleasure and not a duty. Even if you're writing about science, you can't have those stretches of your book where you're saying to yourself, well, this is not very interesting, but the reader needs to know this in order to understand what's coming later. Cut that out. Every page, nearly every paragraph, needs to feel to some degree like a guilty pleasure. And that's hard. That's why we get the big bucks. Ha ha.
Yeah. I know what you mean. Well, David, this has been a phenomenal conversation. I really appreciate you taking the time to have this conversation with me.
I appreciate your depth of interest and your depth of homework and thinking about what I might have to say. So it's been a pleasure for me too.
Yeah. Yeah. Mordecai, I can't wait to read your latest book whenever that appears. I'm very interested in that subject, and I'm sure it'll be a phenomenal book on all things, not just the edge case of contagious cancer, but I assume that's a lead-in to a much broader scientific opus.
It is. How we think about cancer, how we understand cancer, how we recognize our own mortality. Mortality is built in, and cancer is part of mortality. And how we treat cancer, how we treat children with cancer, and how we treat adults with cancer.
Yeah,
and how we learn from elephants and Tasmanian devils. That's all going to be in there, I think.
Well, I can't wait.
Thank you, Ted.
We'll leave it there. Thanks, okay. David.
You're welcome. You're very welcome.